If the world were like a Sleep Number mattress, everything would adapt for your comfort. Because as your life changes and your body changes, Sleep Number mattresses adapt and shift to give you personalized comfort night after night. And now everything's on sale during our Memorial Day event. Save up to $1,200 on mattresses for a limited time. To experience a whole new world of comfort, visit a Sleep Number store or go to sleepnumber.com. Sleep Number, to a good life's sleep.
Are you ready to go? This time tomorrow we'll be on the road, riding with you in the sunnier days. I wouldn't want it any other way.
It's time to name the neglect from typical food advice. Welcome to the Find Your Food Voice podcast, hosted by me, Julie Duffy Dillon. I'm a registered dietitian with 20 years of experience partnering with folks just like you on their food peace journey. What have we learned? Well, cookie cutter approaches exclude too many people, and you don't need to be fixed. It's not you. It's not me. It's all of us. Only together we can start a movement and fix diet culture. And we will. Let's begin with now. Hi there. Welcome to episode 320 of Find Your Food Voice. I am Julie Duffy Dillon, and I have a question for you. What do Gwyneth Paltrow, Snap Benefits, and the Wall Street Journal all, what do they all mean to your relationship with food? Well, actually, that's what we're going to be talking about today. My team and I had a conversation about all the hoopla with Gwyneth Paltrow. If you don't know what I mean, it's probably better. It's like such a shit show. But basically, she was talking about some of her ways that she diets, and basically without consuming calories. And my team and I were talking about this, and you know, really, what do we as individuals think, and what do we know bring forth to the podcast to discuss as it relates to our relationship with food? And what we kind of came to in our conversation is this dichotomy. This abundance versus scarcity, and the haves and the have-nots. And this, no matter where you are in that kind of conversation, whether you have access to abundance, abundant food, abundant money, abundant power, or you're the opposite, or you're somewhere in between, this impacts your relationship with food. So we are going to unpack it. I have invited Rachel Popick to jump behind the mic. She's someone who has a lot of experience in her own community with something called community fridges. If you've never heard of them, we're going to talk a little bit about them in this episode. And I invite you, again, no matter where you are in your relationship with food and what kind of access you have, I invite you to this conversation, and I hope it helps you to shine a light on what you want your next steps to be as you are breaking up a diet culture and healing your relationship with food, and how you can contribute to make the world a better place for everyone and improve their own relationship with food. All right, before we get to my conversation with Rachel, a quick word from our sponsors. This episode of Find Your Food Voice is brought to you by my Decoding and Demystifying PCO Carb Cravings webinar. I wish you weren't taught to be ashamed of your PCOS carb cravings. You aren't weak for having them. You aren't gluttonous for eating in response to them either. You aren't doing it wrong. I wish you were taught these carb cravings are insightful. I have noticed there are two different types of PCOS carb cravings that give amazing, distinct intel. I wish you were taught from the get-go that both are to be trusted. Our PCOS carb cravings Annoying as fuck? You bet. Should they be ignored or tricked? No way. Let's fix this. I'm putting together a mini training on PCOS carb cravings. It's a bite-sized lesson to help you move from chaotic with cravings to decoding their wisdom. You'll also learn the two different types of PCOS cravings and what they are telling you about your current PCOS symptom management. At this free webinar, you also get a peek into PCOS Power. It's an open house tour of all that is included. The learning modules, the community, the workbook, the discounted dispensary, and so much more. And remember, it's free. So if you are interested, go to bit.ly/PCOS carb cravings. Again, it's bit.ly/PCOS carb cravings, and you will get to all the information and a place to sign up. Hey, Rachel, how's it going?
Good, Julie. How are you?
I'm good. It's so cool. I'm just so glad that we're going to have this conversation. I feel like it's been building up and it's just going to like burst out of us. So I'm really excited to do this. And I want the listener to know kind of like where we're coming from. We had a conversation in, we call it our dream team, when Yelly, Colleen, and Rachel and I all meet.
We're having a dream team meeting.
We love each other and working together. But we had a meeting and it was right after Colleen and I had recorded the episode that was on the Wall Street Journal article on how food is more expensive, so we should just skip breakfast. And then Gwyneth Paltrow's interview where she talks about her like not eating and valuing her detox and not spiking her blood sugar, all that shit was happening. And then, of course, Brendan Fraser got his Oscar for that movie he was in. That all was happening kind of around the same time. And we're like, what should we talk about on the podcast? Do we really want to talk about Brendan Fraser? Like, ugh. And then Gwyneth Paltrow, do we really want to talk about her? And you brought up something about SNAP benefits. And it was like we had like a collective mind blown because these celebrities, not celebrities, but like Gwyneth Paltrow and folks who just are aligned with the stuff that she's doing with food, talking about spending money to like not eat. And at the same time, SNAP benefits were either ending or about to end. And I know you're more involved in this conversation, Rachel, and like in your community doing a lot of work with this conversation. So could you fill me and the listener in? Like, what's going on with SNAP benefits? And have they ended? Am I wrong? Give me like the timeline.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Yeah. So as many people probably know, food insecurity in the U.S. is a huge issue. In 2019, it was like a little over 10% of U.S. households were food insecure. So that's like over 35 million people. And that's a figure that they estimate almost doubled during the pandemic. And it probably goes without saying, but rates among Black and Latinx households are higher at like 19 and 16% respectively due to all of the systemic racism and oppression that those groups face. And so during the pandemic, due to the increase in food insecurity, they created what were called extended SNAP benefits. So states were providing essentially two SNAP payments a month instead of one. And so that has been going on since March of 2020 for 3 years. And by the end of this month, all states will have phased out those extended SNAP benefits. So it's not that all SNAP benefits are ending, but those extended payments, those secondary payments are going away. So for some families at a minimum, that's like a reduction of $90 a month. But for other families, you know, based on family size, et cetera, that's up to $250 of money dedicated towards grocery shopping that is going to go away. And that is coming at the same time or a little bit after all of those other critical pandemic economic support programs like the extended unemployment payments, free school lunches, the extended child tax credit, all of those things have also ended. At the same time as we're seeing a downturn in the economy and food prices continuing to rise, a la the Wall Street Journal article. So that's kind of putting a lot of folks in this country on what we like to call a hunger cliff. So essentially, like, a sudden gap in food benefits that Americans are experiencing, that's going to kind of push them over the cliff from being marginally secure in being able to access food to no longer being able to access food.
Yes. Oh my gosh. At the same time, we have Gwyneth Paltrow talking about like doing a fast and not wanting to spike her blood sugar. And it's just such a like dichotomy. And it's, as a team, I know we were like, wow, that's really like, I think I want to say out of touch because I'm in that group too. Like I don't experience food insecurity, but like just knowing at the same time, there's like this disconnect. And I think that's really powerful. And I have a feeling it's also like intentional. Like there's something about being so engrossed in diet culture because you want to have access, that you want to, I don't know, just be able to connect with other people, have support, like the many different reasons why people diet. So they think they're doing the right thing, how that can be so distracting. So we don't see what's happening over there with food insecurity. I say over there, you know, like it's this big, huge thing all around us all the time, but like to keep our like self-focus on the individual, it just is really scary. And also like, I know it's always been around. Like this is the way it works, right? Like, I don't know. Tell me what you're thinking about like the two at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. And I think it's really interesting when we talk about the kind of individual and, you know, the systems that we live under, white supremacy, capitalism, et cetera. Really like put the onus on the individual for everything. We live in a very individualistic society, and diet culture totally fits into that, right? Like when the onus of weight loss and conforming to like diet culture standards of like thinness and beauty are all put on the individual. Like if a diet failed, if you didn't lose the X weight that you tried to on a diet, it's not because the diet didn't work. It's because you did it wrong and you just need to try another one. And so that in turn benefits capitalism because it's selling more diets. It continues the perpetuation of like the diet culture industry, but it also keeps the focus so much on the individual that people aren't seeing these systemic issues that are really, really to blame for folks who are experiencing, you know, hunger, folks who are not experiencing optimal health. It's not because of individual choices, but it's more those social determinants of health.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the themes of misogyny are just like so loud right now in my head. How people who are already marginalized and have historically been for centuries are told, well, we need to make cuts in the budget. So you're going to have to do more with less, you know? And it is like, that's like a massive diet culture theme. Like that is just interwoven throughout. Like, oh, well, you know, you can get by with less. You can just intermittent fast until noon. Like what, whatever, you know, you don't want to spike your blood sugar. I'm thinking way too much about Gwyneth. She does not need this much energy, but it just is, the type of system of oppression affecting everyone to cut back, whether it's because you have abundant access. So you need to make sure you don't, oh my God, don't eat the cake. And then, we don't have enough money to help you because we have kept you out for so long. You don't have access. So you're just going to have to do more with less. Exactly. You used the phrase when we were kind of prepping, like tightening the belt. I'm like, ooh, that's a good one. Like That just is central theme through all of it. And, you know, something that comes up, we've had a few letters about that for the podcast, where people have written letters to food and mentioned their childhood history of not having access to enough food, like to, or, and also witnessing their caregivers eating less so that as children they could eat enough or closer to enough, and talking about how they connect that history to their now, when they're living with enough access to food as an adult and experiencing binge eating disorder, and just being curious about that connection. And something that I've talked on the podcast a lot about is how, like, how dieting causes like a trauma in our body, you know, and our body remembers. Mm-hmm. So that when a diet is about ready to start, many people will binge before they even start, before they even start to restrict, because it's like the body knows what's about to happen and it's trying to save itself. And same thing with if you have a history of not having enough food at home, or just being aware that that was like, it was scarce. And so other people were having to eat less to make sure you had enough, that your body also remembers that too. And so if you have a history of food insecurity and are experiencing binge eating disorder, like that was a trauma that you experienced for a long time. And I don't know, I have a feeling that like the way diet culture has like encouraged our brain to react to binging or anything that kind of feels like that, whether it's like, whether we call it emotional eating or stress eating or whatever, like that it's our fault. But like, what if part of what's going on or all of it is because of this history? And it's the, where we point the finger is the systemic oppressions, not your lack of willpower, your lack of knowledge. Like it's none of those things, you know? And there's a few very skilled therapists who can do trauma work with folks to help them process that trauma and help it have a different experience in the body to be less like activating, which for many people has been the way that they've been able to like heal that part. And that's only though if you still have access now to enough food. Like what if you don't?
Right.
And yeah, like so something that, you know, we were talking about is important to name is if you experience food insecurity now or in the past, like it would be really normal to experience binging or these kind of out of control eating experiences, because your body is like wanting you to stay alive. You know, this is not that like you're lazy or lacking any willpower. So, I just think it was important to kind of mention that. Anything I left out in there that you think is important too?
I think the only thing, as you were talking, it kind of, I know that when we're talking about food insecurity, we're specifically talking about those who don't have access to enough food for themselves and their families due to financial restrictions or, you know, like if they live in a food desert, et cetera. But you can also look at like restriction and like disordered eating behaviors as a type of food insecurity.
For sure.
And so 100%. I think it kind of, I'm making that connection between like whenever there is a history of food insecurity, whether it be because of financial reasons or because of diet culture reasons, that encourages like a disconnected relationship with your body and with food. And so it's common and it's so understandable that that would lead to binge eating behaviors or binge eating disorder.
Yeah. Yeah. Whenever we take like the 30,000 foot view of food behavior, it becomes apparent, like the body can't really tell the difference between I don't have access to enough food right now, or I'm on a diet and so I'm not getting enough food right now, or, you know, I have to eat less because I'm eating for show around someone. And the body doesn't know the difference. Like the mind sometimes will have different conversations going on with it. But like when you get to like the primal level, like the amygdala, you know, you're getting down to like the lizard brain and stuff like that. Like it can't really tell the difference. And it's just doing what it needs to do to save you. And, you know, someone who has a really kind of concrete conversation around this, her name is Ellen Satter. And Ellen Satter is a dietitian and a therapist. She's actually the, when I learned about her training in those two things is why I got trained as a counselor too. But as I talk about and refer Ellen Satter's work, I just want to let you know there are some themes of weight normative behaviors. There's some O word discussions. So I just want to let you know, in case you go down the Google path and you find what I'm talking about, just take care of yourself, especially if that word is stigmatizing to you. But Ellen Satter has something called the food hierarchy of needs that really informed a lot of my way of interacting with food behavior, or just like my thought of it. And if you can imagine like Maslow's hierarchy needs, it's kind of similar. It's a triangle. And she talks about how there's different levels of ways of relating to food based on how much access you have to food and what the world is telling you about food. And so of course, the bottom of the triangle is enough food. And it doesn't matter why someone doesn't have enough. If someone doesn't have enough food, helping to manage PCOS by, I don't know, increasing fiber intake. I'm just randomly throwing something out there. That's going to be a moot point. Like the managing diseases through nutrition, which is like, as a dietitian, that's what I'm specifically trained to do. That's the very tip. That's like the self-actualization version of the food hierarchy of needs. It's pointless. Well, it's not pointless because it's on the point, but like it really is like missing the point is probably really what I need to say. But yeah, like having consistent access to food is the foundation. And until you have consistent access to food, doing all the rest will be kind of a waste of your time and a waste of your resources, a waste of your bandwidth. And you know, so like there's a lot of people that will not have access to enough food, but then also be worrying about cholesterol levels. And I can remember giving diet instructions at the hospital after someone had a heart attack. And I knew they were going home to a place where they didn't have access to enough food, but yet the doctor was telling me I needed to give them a diet instruction to limit their saturated fat intake. And I was like, really? Like, that's what we're worried about? Like, this is what we're worried about.
Right.
I think we need to make sure that this person has actually enough food at home. Then we can talk about the other things if that even is necessary at that point, because I think the stress of food insecurity probably impacted their heart attack more than anything. So, exactly. But I want to kind of like move the conversation to a place. Actually, as I say, before I even go there, I'll say the Ellen Satter, if you Google Ellen Satter hierarchy of needs, we'll put a link to it in the show notes, but in case you're just listening and can't, you'll find it. So in case you want to read more on that, especially if you're a clinician and you're like, ooh, I want to know more. It's very important kind of way of considering food behavior, and also informed the next thing I want to say, which is, you know, I'm thinking about a listener taking in this conversation, and it reminds me of, you know, when I'm totally clocked out, you know, I'm not working, I'm walking Doug through the neighborhood, I see a neighbor friend, and they'll start talking about maybe they are bad because they ate something, or they want to eat healthier, what do I recommend? And the first thing I always ask is, well, do you have enough food at home? You know, if they're like, well, I want to be like eat healthier, what do you recommend? And I'm like, well, do you have enough food at home? And, you know, I definitely like, I live in a neighborhood where lots of privilege. So I'm not surprised to hear, yeah, I do have enough food at home. I'm like, good. Now let's make sure everybody else does too in our community, because like you can increase your fruit and vegetable intake, or you can, I don't know, eat organic. I'm just thinking of random things again, because it really doesn't matter. Like all those things are such a small drop in the health bucket, you know, for an individual. And what makes so much more of an impact are these things called social determinants of health. And for you, the listener, if you're someone who is food secure, like, and you've always had access to enough food, or at least have for a long time, and you're wondering like, okay, but I want to help my relationship with food. Something that's really important for you to know is part of how diet culture has fucked with all of us, like, and to make it like us instead think about, I need to make sure I'm eating good instead of noticing how many people are hungry. And if we take the eye off of diet culture's like seduction, you know, I do think of it as a seduction. Like, it's like they're totally captivating us with this big lie that we need to focus on these uber details. If we can like just look away from that for a second and look around us in our community and people who are experiencing hunger, like this hunger cliff, that is so scary. That is, and not okay. That is happening in the United States of America.
Right.
I think you said it earlier, the greatest country in the world, right? Like, why are we?
You have bunny ears.
Please know there were bunny ears. But, and for those people who do identify it as the greatest country in the world, like, we need to make it better then. Like, because for those of us who have access to enough food and we're not experiencing these systems of oppression, or not many of them, our health is not going to be impacted that much by how many vegetables we eat. But for folks who have more consistent access to food and they haven't, fixing that and like paying attention to that will tremendously impact. Like, the amount of change you can make with food behavior individually on your health outcomes, it's only like 7%. Mm-hmm. The rest comes from genetics and social determinants of health. We can't change genetics, you know, like once you're out here, it's set. But like social determinants of health, like we can't change it. Like an individual who's experiencing racism right now cannot fix it. Like that's going to be all of us together that needs to fix it, you know? So, yeah, that's something that I just hope that if you're listening, you're like, well, how does this impact me? Well, it impacts the community you live in. So we can lift everybody up by being aware of these things, and also in a community kind of level, helping to help people in your community not experience this hunger cliff. I totally got on like a little bit of a rant. But, okay. You know, like something, you know, something that like you mentioned, but as we were kind of preparing, is like food is political. And absolutely. I know you believe strongly in that. Is that, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. I mean, I think to your point, like there's only so much that your behaviors are going to change your individual health. And we really should stop thinking so much about the individual. I'm not saying like, disregard mm-hmm. yourself mm-hmm. and your health and like your mental well-being, but we really need to focus on the systems and the community and yeah, food is political, like how it's grown, how it's created, what we choose to eat, where we get our food, who's doing the production of the food, who's growing the food, how the food is cooked, who's cooking the food. All of those things are political, and diet culture is so pervasive that mm-hmm. it makes it easy for the people in power to do things like cut the extended SNAP benefits without it being like a huge outcry and outrage like across the country, because we're so steeped in diet culture where there's nothing wrong with, you know, quote unquote, losing a few pounds or eating a little less, or the tightening of the belt kind of mentality. Like as we, you know, kind of harping back to the Gwyneth Paltrow thing, the Wall Street mm-hmm. Journal article, like those things, people don't even bat an eye at those suggestions. And so it makes it easy for people in power to, you know, reduce the amount that people are getting to contribute to their food security without really any pushback. And mm-hmm. to your point about, you know, your neighbor and talking to your neighbor, like I think if we all spent a little bit more time asking those questions, analyzing those systems, and making sure that everyone else in our communities and surrounding communities had enough to eat, we would be advancing like the health of everyone a lot more than just focusing on how many organic fruits and vegetables that, you know, I'm consuming on a daily basis.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think about for, there may be someone listening who is hearing this and feeling guilt and feeling ashamed. And I also think that is part of diet culture.
Absolutely.
Because it's keeping you focused on you as an individual. And so we don't see what people in power are really doing. And so what I encourage you to do, if like you're hearing this, if it's landing that way for you, because you like being so engrossed and captivated and seduced by diet culture also is a form of oppression. You know, this is another type of systemic oppression. And so I am invested in helping you to no longer be invested with diet culture. Like for you, the listener, that is what I will die doing. This is what I will be doing forever because it is a system of oppression that you are experiencing. And so by you like feeling that guilt, that is part of how diet culture has wired you to respond, is still to blame yourself. And what I hope you can do whenever you come across that guilt or shame in this conversation, I hope it pisses you the fuck off. Like, I hope it makes you so mad. And misogyny has trained us to not be comfortable with anger. So it may feel real wrong. But when I hear folks getting angry at the system's oppression, like, again, this is a 30,000 foot view. So this is not like an individual, but like looking at the big picture, that's when a person's relationship with food starts to shift in the way that they want it to. It's because it's taking it off of you, the individual, doing something wrong. We contribute to oppression, but like,
absolutely.
And we also can contribute to go against it, you know? So, when you run up across, you get real close to that guilt or shame, or if you're feeling it real hardcore, I encourage you to call it out, say, hello, I was waiting for you. And get real mad, get really mad, and maybe go through some of the things that are happening with this hunger cliff. That is a phrase that I will always remember. Like, that is visceral right now in my body. Yeah. And so, which I think is real important and motivating and pisses me off. So, so yeah, that's what I think about, like, for what's kind of like the next thing to do. If you're someone who's not experiencing food insecurity, maybe never has, what about for folks listening who either are experiencing food insecurity, know someone who is, or wants to get involved in being a part of the change? Rachel, where would you encourage people to like look to?
So I would say that, you know, as awful as the pandemic was, one of the bright spots that came out of the pandemic was the creation and the popping up of what are called community fridges all over the US, all over the world, but all over the US. And they are places where, and I know you and Colleen referenced this in that Wall Street Journal episode as well, but they are places that you can go and they're open 24/7. Usually there's a fridge, so like for refrigerated and frozen goods, and then normally a pantry for shelf stable stuff. They're open 24/7 and you can take whatever you need out of them. And likewise, if you are someone who is listening, who has enough food on your table and you want to do something about this problem, you can also stock those community fridges 24/7. And there are two websites that come to mind where they have almost like a community fridge finder search feature. And we'll put them in the show notes, but it's changex.org and what is called Freege, like F-R-E-E-D-G-E, like free.
Oh, nice.
Fridge. I might be pronouncing that wrong. But they,
okay.
Both of those websites have community fridge finders. So you can like plug in your zip code and find community fridges, which are super common in more urban areas. But there's also on both of those websites, and there's just Google in general, there's tons of resources on how to start a community fridge if that's something that you're interested in. Usually a group of people will partner with a business or a church mm-hmm. or a school that will like host the fridge. The fridge will be there and they pay the minimal, you know, electricity fee to mm-hmm. keep the fridge running. And then a group of volunteers, you know, keeps it clean, solicits donations, etc. And so I highly, highly recommend getting involved in a local community fridge or maybe talking to mm-hmm. people in your community about starting one if you don't have one near you. It's also a great way to divert food waste. Like a lot of mm-hmm. local businesses who at the end of the day, you know, have food that's going to, that they can't sell the next day, they'll donate that food instead of throwing it in the trash. So they're also a great way to divert food waste, mm-hmm. which is something that I'm really big on. Mm-hmm. And if there are no community fridges in your area, or that's too overwhelming to start one, there are also food banks all over the place, food pantries, mm-hmm. Organizations that you can get plugged into to volunteer and also get access to food through them. Mm-hmm. And something I do want to flag that Julie, you and I talked about while we were preparing that I think is really important to remember is that food pantries, community fridges, institutions like that aren't places for you to offload the stuff in your house that's like close to expiring or expired or mm-hmm. the stuff that like you really have no, like you don't want to eat and no one else is going to want to eat. Like they're not places for you to like offload your trash. If you're going to work with those organizations or stock community fridges, make sure that the food you're bringing them is quality, is, you know, it can be canned and frozen. And obviously there's nothing wrong with canned food, prepackaged food, but it should be good quality. So that's, that's my little rant.
Yes. I'm so glad you added that because I know that's an issue, where I live as well. Like that's something the food banks have mentioned too. Like we actually cannot give people expired food. Like, exactly. And you know, that's something about like preparing food or, just like food and it's like concept is like a nourishing, loving kind of gesture. So kind of offloading the stuff that is expired. Or, I don't know. It just like kind of gets in the way of that to me exactly. too. So
yeah, it feels counter intuitive.
Mm-hmm,
to
that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Exactly. So, well, we need to wrap it up, but I am so glad that we had this conversation. It was kind of just happenstance that we like came to this and I'm so glad we did because, I know for us on our dream team, you know, these are the things that we end up like talking a lot about. Like, and so I'm glad we had a chance to like actually push record on part of that conversation. So thank you, Rachel, for sharing your, experiences and, you know, sharing everything to help us get up to speed.
Of course. Thank you for giving a platform to have this conversation.
All right. So let's get to work. Take care. So there you have it. I hope you got something out of my conversation with Rachel Popick. And all of the resources that we mentioned are in the show notes for you below. And we do hope it helps you to decide what your next steps are going to be. And before we head out and I conclude this episode, I want to say thank you so much for supporting the Find Your Food Voice podcast. And if you enjoyed this episode, we would love it if you left a rating or review, or you subscribed or shared the episode, maybe with a friend, maybe on your social media. Be sure to tag us at Food Voice RD. And we really appreciate it. Like helping more people to find the show helps us to be able to to make this podcast and help more people just have access to their own food voice. All right. And this show, it was sponsored today by my free PCOS carb cravings class. It's called Decode and Demystify Your PCOS Carb Cravings. And you can get to all the details and sign up at bit.ly/PCOS carb cravings. All right. Until next week, take care. Thank you for listening. I am Julie Duffy Dillon, and this is the Find Your Food Voice podcast. Ready to join the anti-diet movement and take the Food Voice Pledge? Go to julieduffydillon.com and sign your name to the growing list of people saying no to diets and yes to their own food voice. The Find Your Food Voice podcast is produced by me, Julie Duffy Dillon, and my team of kick-ass folks. I couldn't make the show without Yelly Cruz, assistant producer and resident book fiend, and Colleen Bremner, customer service coordinator and professional hype master. Audio editing is from Toby Lyles at 24 Sound. Music is Fly Free by Hartley. Are you looking for episode transcripts? Get them at julieduffydillon.com, where you can also submit letters for the podcast, give us feedback, and sign the Food Voice Pledge. We need your voice to end diet culture. We literally can't do this without you. Subscribe to the Find Your Food Voice podcast to get weekly inspiration and education on how we can defeat diet culture and reclaim our own food voice. I look forward to seeing you here next week for another episode of the Find Your Food Voice podcast. Take care.